Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up, how closely the show The Bear resembles an actual kitchen.
And an author making his young adult debut on writing for that audience.
But first, time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We are about to bring independents into the Republican Party and Democrats into the Republican Party because we know that America First policies, and we saw this under President Trump, are the only way to solve the problems that we're facing right now.
The older voters, I mean, that's the question. Do they say, okay, I'm going to vote the party line ticket. Do I just stay with my party, or do I stay home, or do I consider voting from a Democrat?
I think he's the worst senator. You know, this guy, Mark Kelly, he campaigns as a moderate, but he votes like a radical. Anytime Joe Biden has a new harebrained idea, a new proposal to further send our country on the wrong track, Mark Kelly's there for it.
The people threatening our democracy, our state, and our personal freedoms aren't just banging at my door. They're banging at Arizona's door to take over our state and any sense of normalcy that we have left.
And with us to talk about the results of Tuesday's primary and what it could mean for November's election, our former gubernatorial candidate, Christine Jones. Christine, good morning.
Good morning.
And Democratic strategist and former deputy director for the Biden campaign, Tony Connie. Tony, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Christine, let me start with you on this, and this is not meant to be sensitive. I do not have an agenda on this one, but I saw Karen Taylor Robeson's concession letter, shall we say, from earlier today, and she has not come out to formally endorse Carrie Lake, and a lot of expectations are she will not do that. Can I ask when you got out of the gubernatorial race, or when you were defeated, rather, did you fully endorse, fully throated endorse Doug Ducey, or were you hesitant for a while?
Well, both Scott Smith and I, and if you remember, Scott was a candidate along with me, got together and issued a very positive endorsement of Doug after we sat down with him and talked through a few issues and understood where he stood on some things that where we differed. But yeah, in the end, we absolutely did. And I suspect that Karen Taylor Robeson will do the same thing. I can tell you today she's probably reeling and she's probably having a little PTSD. But I think when she sits down with Carrie, when she has a chance to talk about the issues upon which they disagree, I think you'll see a very enthusiastic endorsement. And I suspect she'll even go on the road and maybe surrogate for Carrie, and you'll see an endorsement there shortly.
So what if she doesn't do that? Will that give us any signs?
Well, you know, the establishment is reeling as well, because for a long time, they've kind of had a system for approaching these elections. And when an outsider who's never run for office before, who's never really even been involved in politics before, comes out with such a wave and such a movement and basically leads the polls the whole way, they have to reimagine how they're going to approach this. So I do think it sends signals, but I can't underestimate the power of wanting to defeat a liberal Democrat. And I think in the end, that will overpower the doubt about Carrie Lake.
Tony, I presume you're not a fan of Karen Taylor Robeson, but how disturbing is it that Carrie Lake won the primary? Or is it good strategy from the Democratic side?
I don't think it's a strategic thing either way. I think that, you know, I think that that's a narrative that was really pushed by the Karen campaign, that there was a preference for Carrie Lake, to be honest. But I do think that it's scary that she won. And if you look at the whole primary, you know, what did they disagree on when it came to policies? They didn't, right? And so the thing is, the Republican Party in Arizona is completely controlled by the Kelly board Trump wing of the party. And so even if it's a small percentage of the overall, you know, chunk of voters, that's what we are dealing with. And voters have a real choice. And if the choice is a woman who is a social worker and worked with domestic violence victims in Katie Hobbs, who, you know, is a public servant, versus someone who just doesn't believe in supporting our Constitution and thinks that an election should be taken away from the person who wins. And that's like the the greatest thing about her. Like, there's so much worse things. You know, if that's the choice that people are making, I think people should really think about their values a little bit stronger, a little bit harder.
Christine, let me ask you about that, because when you say that you anticipate that Karen Taylor Robeson will sit down with Kari Lake and talk about some of the issues they disagreed on, to Tony's point, on policy, it didn't seem like there was a lot of disagreement. It was mostly personality-wise, style-wise, you know, rhetoric-wise, that kind of thing. Does that play into the decision from Robeson of how she's going to proceed? And does that, I don't know, make that potential meeting maybe a little more awkward?
Well, it's always awkward. You just spent the last year beating each other up, and then you have to shake hands and, you know, smoke the peace pipe together. So those meetings are always a little bit awkward. But I think, and I love Tony's already, you know, talking the Democrat talking points here. But and that's what he's supposed to do, right? He's a consultant, and I honor and respect that. But in the end, what's the most important to Republicans and probably most independents is let's avoid the policies that the liberal Democrats, who are skewing way to the left on the progressive side, are proposing. And let's band together and make sure that that doesn't happen in Arizona and, you know, potentially not anywhere else.
So, Tony, from a Democrat's perspective, does Katie Hobbs try to appeal in some way to Robeson voters? Is there a way that she can try to win some of them over to her side?
Yeah, I think that she will. And people are going to see that she's going to run a common sense campaign that, you know, she won statewide before. People forget she won statewide before only 4 years ago. And, you know, I think people are going to get to know her a little bit better. They're going to like her. And, you know, she has a track record, because when you're the leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate and you want to get anything done, you have to work with Republicans. And she's worked with Republican governors before. And so, you know, there's probably footage of Doug Ducey praising her for the work she did to, you know, get the backlog of rape kits, you know, through, and things like, you know, the opiate epidemic bill that he passed. And so she's going to be willing to work with people. And my question is this: who's going to be more willing to work with people on the opposite party, Katie Hobbs or Kari Lake? That's the real question. If we all care about the bipartisanship when there's criticism of Senator Sinema. But what about with Kari Lake? Can you even imagine her working with Democrats? She won't.
Christine, there is a question about even how well she might work with some of those Republicans, folks like Rusty Bowers, for example, who ended up losing his legislative race. I want to go back just slightly to what you said about Kari Lake, Robeson, whatever, sort of big picture in terms of whether it is better to vote for, as you phrase it, sort of the failed policies of the Biden administration. I'm curious, though, does this in any way parallel with the criticism Doug Ducey got when he supported Wendy Rogers, for example, as opposed to the Democrat who she was running against, because he made it clear, obviously, the numbers are, you know, we talk about, you know, 16 and 31 in the legislature. Is that something that is just a practical thought that Kari Lake's more likely to get through the issues that Republicans care about, as opposed to whether it may, in fact, hurt the state, as some rhetoric has suggested?
Well, okay, so let's unpack a lot of things that you just
said.
Three,
four questions.
The legislature is going to continue to be close. We see the legislature now in the primaries on the Republican side skewing probably a little bit more conservative. So she's going to have to bring those people in. The Democrats are skewing a little bit more liberal and progressive. She's going to have to bring those people in. When you're talking about almost a 50-50 split, you don't have a choice. And frankly, people know Kari. They've been seeing her in their living rooms for two decades, or almost three decades, I guess it is. They know her. They're going to feel comfortable approaching her. And she's in person a very likable, very compelling person. And I don't think she's going to have trouble sitting down with leadership from the House and leadership from the Senate and saying, this is what we're working on today. Let's get the things that we can agree on and let's go forward to help Arizona. Obviously, we all know in the primaries, you have to talk about your party's issues. But in the general, I think you're going to see a Kari that's focused on water, on the border, on education, on all of the things that matter to all of the Arizonans. And I think Katie has a real challenge because, you know, she's upside down on likability. I guess they both are, but Katie's more upside down on likability. And frankly, what Connie talks about in terms of rape kits and, you know, the things that she's now claiming she did, when the Republican Governors Association gets a hold of that and finds out none of those where she was a primary sponsor, those ads are going to write themselves, right? So, yes, Katie, Katie is a public servant and a career politician, and she's worked with people. But I think you got to be really careful taking credit for things and talking about working across the aisle when you're running against a woman who's been talking to all of the public for 30 years. It's a real trick for Katie.
Tony, is it safe to say that this race, now that Carrie Lake is the nominee, does that make national Democrats more willing to spend some money in it than they maybe would have if Karen Taylor Robeson had been the nominee?
I don't know. I think that this is, no matter who won, this was going to be one of the most competitive races for governor in the entire country. And, you know, it's not – I mean, there's so many important races nationally. You know, there's a race for Secretary of State, which may very well be the most important race in the entire country of all elections. And, you know, there's a U.S. Senate race. Arizona is a battleground, and it's going to stay a battleground. And one of the things that I think a lot of the sort of Republican operatives in Arizona haven't adjusted to is the fact that that outside – money and focus and scrutiny. Let's not forget about scrutiny, that is coming and it's already here. And so I think that there will be investment. And I think that even if there is an outside investment, there's going to be a bunch of money from small donors that are coming into the candidates themselves from around the country.
Christine, you mentioned the Republican Governors Association. I wanted to ask you about the statement that that organization issued congratulating Carrie Lake on winning the nomination. Is it notable in any way that the statement in it was from the vice chair, the governor, I believe, of Iowa, as opposed to the chair of the Republican Governors Association, who is Doug Ducey?
Well, this is classic Doug, right? Doug, that's what's good for Doug. And so, you know, he endorsed the other candidate. And with all due respect to the governor, he probably wanted somebody else to make that statement. The vice chair also happens to be another woman governor, and so that may have compelled them. But in the end, you know, these things are changing all the time. And if you think about it dynamically, their message on the day after the election or the day after the race was called is going to change constantly between now and the general election, depending on where the polls are. Katie, if you look at the head-to-head on the average of polls that we've seen so far, is polling about 4 to 5 points ahead, which, to Tony's point, makes this a battleground state. And so I think, yeah, Doug's going to jump in, right, when it's appropriate, and you're going to see those messages change and change and change as the polls go up and down. And I can't overemphasize the fact that I think Katie has a real challenge running against a person that everybody has known and loved for such a long time.
Tony, you mentioned Secretary of State, so let's balance this out. If, in fact, Robeson and Lake agreed on almost everything. One thing they didn't quite agree on was the idea of let's talk about 2020 over and over and over again. The fact that the Republicans nominated Mark Finch for Secretary of State, the fact that Carrie Lake has been called an election denier, what does that say to you as far as how much 2020 is actually going to come into play? And one would think that would favor those not talking about 2020. It may not, depending on what the electorate thinks. How big an issue is that going to be in this campaign?
Well, I think that Christine's very smart and she's right that the Republicans should be trying to appeal to moderates. But I just don't think they're going to be able to. I don't think that they are going to be able to resist attacking Adrian Fontes, who is the Maricopa County Recorder, and Katie Hobbs, who's Secretary of State. And if you look at the immediate statements afterwards, they haven't. And, you know, the forces in the Republican Party that have been enabled by you know, the establishment and sort of the mainstream Republicans for years by financing the elections of these far right figures that even they themselves, when you sit down and get a beer with them, they say that they're nuts, right? But they're going to still help them and all that kind of stuff. Those forces are more powerful today than they were 3 days ago. And I just don't see them making the pivot that is the logical one to make. I think that they are going to continue to push these lies. That is the motivation for them to get in the race. And it's dangerous and scary. And I think voters care about it. I do think, but it's not their top issue. I think they're going to be just very frustrated that the candidates aren't talking about issues that, you know, impact their lives.
Kristi, we've been lucky enough to have you on, obviously, many times over the last couple of years. And fortunately, we haven't had to stop talking about 2020. So let me ask you basically the same question I asked Tony, which was, how big an issue does this become? And if it is too much of an issue, if 2020 is too much of an issue, which how can it not be with Mark Fincham as a Secretary of State nominee? Does that hurt the Republicans' chances to have a big banner year in 2022, which as of a few months ago, most people expected?
I don't think so. In fact, if you heard Kerry's first post-victory interview this morning, she stayed away from that like it was the plague, which is the right thing to do. And, you know, if you look at the polling numbers, something like 78 or 80% of the population want election integrity. They want transparency. They want all of the legal votes to count. The Democrats, you know, cried about it in 2016. The Republicans cried about it in 2020. Those things matter to all of the people. So if Mark Fincham can stick to the actual nugget, which is let's just make sure that the elections are safe and secure and transparent and not, you know, wave the flag of the, you know, sort of moniker that the Democrats have given them as election deniers, I think they'll be okay. But I do think you'll see Kerry separate herself from that messaging, and as well she should, because she should be talking now about the policies that matter to everybody. Everybody wants their child to get a good education. Everybody wants to know they're going to have clean, abundant drinking water in their home in 100 years, right? For their children and their grandchildren. All of those things that matter. And I think Kerry is pretty disciplined. We've seen that throughout the primary. For a person who was not politically astute, she has really been disciplined. And so I don't think there's any reason to suspect that she won't be that way in the general. And the top of the ticket kind of defines the message. So I think for Mark Fincham and Blake Masters and the others, that 2022 still becomes a fantastic banner year for the Republicans.
Implying that the complaints by Democrats in 2016 are in any way, shape, or form equivalent to what's happened in 2020 is just a very cynical talking point. And, you know, there were some people who thought that there was influencing on social media and that kind of stuff. The force in the Republican Party were saying that the election was stolen a couple of days ago, right? I mean, this is about dismantling democracy, and somebody has to take a stand against this. And it is so frustrating to just watch the Republican Party in Arizona just immediately kind of forget that this is existential stuff. This is scary. And I just wish there was people willing to stand up for what's right here.
That's Tony Conne. Also with us is Christine Jones. And with Mark Brody in Phoenix, I'm Steve Goldstein.
Christine, let's move to the U.S. Senate campaign, in which Blake Masters became the GOP nominee. Really, it was a two-candidate race between he and Jim Lehman. Mark Brnovich was kind of a distant third. What do you make of the fact that Masters, again, a Trump-endorsed candidate, came out ahead in not a particularly close race?
Yeah, that was a real shocker that the Trump endorsement made that much of a difference in that race. And I just want to touch on one thing about Mark Brnovich. He clearly is the biggest disappointment of this cycle. That race was his to lose. But going back to Masters and Lehman, you know, Lehman spent a lot of money. He was very methodical. He went out, he met the people, he did all of the things that a statewide candidate has to do. And just with that one endorsement, you saw Masters' numbers skyrocket. And I think this goes sort of to the overall power of the Trump endorsement in Arizona. We've seen it in other states as well, not quite as strong though. So now we look at it and every single Trump endorsed candidate won their primary. Does that make Arizona the Trumpiest state? I don't know, but it just does speak to the power of breaking through the noise with something that's meaningful to people. And I also have to make the point here. This cycle, maybe for the first time, voters are starting to ignore and block out negative ad campaigns. And thank goodness for that. It's about time, because none of the negative really seemed to matter. It didn't matter against Lake. It didn't matter against Masters. It didn't matter against Lehman. And I really think if any victory came out of this primary cycle, it was that. It's that people don't listen to that, almost swore, to that noise anymore. And it's good, because what you want to do is vote on policy and vote on competence and vote on the person who can do the best job. I'm not sure we got that in the Senate race, but at any rate, the negative ad rescission, I guess, is a victory to me as a person who had millions of dollars spent against them on essentially lies, right? I'm just so grateful that voters tune that out.
Christine, are you suggesting that it might be actually okay to turn on RTV between now and November?
No, because the RGA, the Republican Governors Association, the minute the election was over, started the negative ads against Katie Hobbs. And Katie Hobbs, the minute the election was over, started the negative ads against the Republicans. So don't turn your TV on.
Okay.
I mean, it's just, it's even noisier now. But I just think it's good that people tune that out, that they're going to other sources for information about candidates.
Sure. So, Tony, from Mark Kelly's perspective, I'm assuming he knew it would be either Blake Masters or Jim Lehman. How does, like, if you are the Kelly campaign and apparently money is no object for them, how do you, for lack of a better word, attack this campaign? How do you try to go after Blake Masters, and how do you try to sell him as a candidate?
I think that the Kelly campaign is going to stay focused like they have been this entire cycle and the last cycle, too, on delivering for Arizonans. And so look at what's happening right now. We're about to get, you know, Mark Kelly was one of the main people pushing for the CHIPS and Science bill that got passed the Senate and signed. He was instrumental in the bipartisan infrastructure legislation. And he's also been pushing really hard to allow Medicare to negotiate for lower drug prices and put caps on spending for seniors. And he's going to talk about those accomplishments. He's going to talk about his, you know, vision for the future. And there will be a contrast to, you know, the Senate candidate Blake Masters, who has already talked about, you know, privatizing Social Security. He's like the guy in your college dorm or in your college class who always had to have the idea to be like the smartest guy in class just to be different than everybody. And so he's got a lot of that kind of stuff. And I do think that you're going to hear about it. You know, Christine thinks negative ads, was this a polite campaign? Like Carrie Lake and Mark Finchem, they went hard negative against their opponents and it worked. And, you know, so did Blake Masters. He called Lehman a bozo in a debate. And you know, and he's right about that. I agree with him on that. But you know, I think that we're going to be seeing negative ads, and I hope that, you know, the thing is they just have to be truthful. But I think that it's going to influence this election too.
Christine, one thing that was fascinating to me about 4 years ago is that approximately 150,000 voters voted for both Kyrsten Sinema and Doug Ducey, and there was discussion if Karen Taylor Robeson had won the Republican primary, would we see the same sort of crossover with Senator Mark Kelly? That seems to be likely impossible when it comes to this. So are we going to see the fight for the middle for independents who aren't quite sure? Does Blake Masters have a chance to get some of those independents that voted for Mark Kelly 2 years ago?
Possibly. And I just want to follow up on what Tony said. Yes, everybody went negative, Tony. That's clear. It didn't seem to be as compelling when Karen Taylor Robeson was spending $1 million a week negative, and it never put a dent in Kerry's numbers. But here's the problem for Kelly. He campaigned. He used the Kyrsten Sinema playbook. I'm an independent. I'm just like you. I'm Arizona. And when he didn't have a record that worked, and it's a very compelling message, particularly when the guy has such a stellar resume. I mean, he's a retired military officer and a pilot and an astronaut. I mean, it's really impressive, right? Today he has a record and he doesn't get to say I'm independent and I'm moderate anymore because he votes with Schumer and Biden almost every single time. So I think Blake goes there, but it's a problem for Blake because he's very young. He has very little track record. And I think if I'm Mark Kelly, I am going right after the fact that he doesn't have any experience. And It's a weakness, right? And the Republicans are going to have to address that and right away.
Well, and Christine, is Blake Masters, forgive me for using this, it's going to sound pejorative, but he, going to what Tony said about him, he, in a non-pejorative way, you could say he's interesting. In a slightly pejorative way, you could say he comes across as kind of weird. Is that something that the Kelly campaign is going to exploit? I mean, could we see independent expenditure groups just talking about some of these weird theories? Even if he wrote them when he was 20, you can't trust him kind of thing.
Oh, sure. And we all do that, right? You go and look at every single thing anybody's ever written and exploit it. The the fact that he doesn't have a record will be helpful, right? He doesn't have a voting record against which Mark Kelly can campaign. But the fact that he's weird, I'm not sure appeals to sort of the lower than 50-year-old voters. It might appeal to older people who don't exist in the technology space where that is normal. Blake Masters is normal in the tech world, right? That's kind of how the people are. So it may have to get segmented out, right, depending on the population that they're speaking to at the time. But yeah, absolutely. Tony's right. They are going to find every single weird thing he ever read or wrote and said, and they're going to use it against him, just like the Republicans did to Barack Obama and just like the Democrats did to John McCain. I mean, this is just the way it works.
Christine, let's move a little bit further down the ballot. Tony referenced the Secretary of State's race, which will be Adrian Fontes on the Democratic side against Mark Fincham on the Republican side, another Trump-endorsed candidate. As we just get underway in the general election, how do you see this race shaking out between Fincham and Fontes?
It's probably the biggest weakness for the Republicans because Adrian Fontes has a history of reforming elections. The lawsuit that came out as a result of my race for Congress required Maricopa County, for example, to take a lot of corrective action, which Adrian Fontes did. So all the signature verification, the wrong precinct voters, the overvoted ballots, all of those things that came out of that litigation that became new law, Adrian fixed all of those, right? And he has that to trumpet. Mark Fincham has pictures of himself at the Capitol on January 6th. I think this is a big problem for the Republicans. And, you know, there's not a lot of public polling on a head-to-head in that race yet, but I have to think if Fontes doesn't make any mistakes, it's probably his race to lose at this point.
Tony, what do you think? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a clear choice. You have, Fontes, who's a Marine, who took an oath to defend our country, and you've got Mark Fincham, who is took an oath to be a part of the militant anti-government group, the Oath Keepers. You know, he has a bad relationship with the truth. You know, Mark Fincham, only a year ago, was lying on official letterhead saying that he had a fellowship at the University of Arizona because he wanted to make himself sound more important while he was pushing to overthrow this election. And, you know, Fontes is an actual lawyer who's defended people's votes. And I think that Fincham is very scary. And he's also, you know, there's also like outlandish stuff. Since January 6th, I've dug a lot into Mark Fincham. There's outlandish stuff about him. He on social media called the death of Paul Walker from Fast and Furious another Clinton side, right? Like saying that the Clintons – he said that about the Oklahoma City bombing too. I mean it's just wild stuff. And I was very surprised with the importance of that race and the fact that Christine's right that he's a huge liability, that the Republican candidates didn't go stronger on him. They didn't go after him. You know, he has a deep record. I have his personnel record from when he was in Kalamazoo. You know, he dresses like he's a cowboy, but he's from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and he brags about being a cop. And right there on his retirement paperwork, it says, poor ratings would not rehire. That's what they said about him as a police officer. And none of that came up in the Republican primary, which is shocking. And, that's one of those races that it just – I really wish he would have lost in the primary because I do think that Fontes is a much stronger candidate and will win, but he is a dangerous figure.
Well, Tony, that brings me to the previous question about how voters behave, which we don't know yet. And obviously, as a Democratic strategist to work for the Biden campaign, obviously you want to see the Democrats run the table. But let me ask you this. Is it possible that voters will pay enough attention based on either looking into things themselves or ads or mailers that they decide they like Kerry Lake, but they do not like Mark Fincham? Because those are going to be next to each other on the ballot. Will there be enough voters who say, yeah, I'm going to go with Lake and Fontes?
I do think that there will be appeal to Republican-leaning independents and Republicans for Democrats at the top of the ticket. But it is true that if you can convince these voters to vote for a Democrat, it's harder to get them to vote for multiple Democrats. I think we saw that when a lot of Republicans voted for Biden and Kelly. But then when we got down ballot last time, they weren't as willing to – to do that. And so I do think that that is a risk, but that's why these campaigns happen. What needs to happen is our candidates need to go and have conversations with everybody independents, Republicans, Democrats, and they need to talk about their values and explain why they support the things they do in a way that can appeal to everybody. Not change their values, not change what they're going for, but just be willing to have conversations with a lot of voters who are reeling. I mean, it doesn't have to be a lot. It could be 10% who are reeling from the slate of frighteningly fringe conservative Republicans that are at the top of the ticket this year.
Christy, let me ask you a very similar question. So as you said, Carrie Lake has been in people's houses for decades as an anchor. She comes across warm in person, whatnot. Is it possible we see a lot of people who do make that decision to say, you know, I'm willing to go with Carrie Lake. She's more interesting, more exciting to me than Katie Hobbs. But Mark Fincham, January 6th, I'm pretty scared.
Well, we've seen it happen before. If you remember in the year that there were all women in all five statewide offices, we had a split, you know, between Republicans and Democrats. That is very possible. I love that Tony is this animated. I've never seen you like this before, Tony, I like it actually, because he's passionate about his issues. The setup, honestly, we call it OPA, right? The opposition research on Mark Fincham is so vast and so easy. I don't really think it's going to be that challenging for Adrian if he can raise money and if he can get his voice heard. You know, the media is pretty consumed by these messages at the top of the ticket. But the one saving grace for Mark might be that he has the power of the loyalty of the Trump voters, which I personally underestimated as recently as 6 months ago. And those people are going to vote for him. And that's almost enough to get him over the top. So I think the Democrats are probably going to spend more on that race than they had maybe originally planned, but they are going to be desperate to keep him out of that office. And I think it's possible to split the ticket at the top.
Christine, let's, in the couple minutes we have left, I want to ask you about what happened this week in Pinal County, where they didn't have enough ballots and some number of voters most likely were disenfranchised. The elections director was fired. The recorder resigned to take that spot. Obviously, kind of a mess down there, to put it nicely. But I guess in the bigger picture of people's skepticism and concern about elections, how much does this sort of play into that?
Well, I hate to use this term, but when I saw that they fired David Frisk and, you know, put in a kind of more known quantity in Virginia Ross, it did strike me as a little bit of an overreaction and a little bit of cancel culture, right? People aren't allowed to make any mistakes now. Maybe the death knell for David Frisk is that he made two mistakes, right?
They had an error.
Yeah, they had an error in the ballots, which meant there was fodder for conspiracy theorists to say there was something going on there. And then the under-providing of ballots, that kind of is an unforgivable mistake. But all of this just lends credibility to the fact that there's something wrong with the elections, and it's going to be more conversation to have, which really appeals to people who, going back to Tony's point, really appeals to the people that thought the election was stolen in 2020.
Tony, does it matter at all? I mean, Pinal County is a pretty Republican county. Does it matter at all for folks who believe that elections are full of conspiracies that this happened in a place like Pinal County?
Yeah, I'm sure it does. But, you know, aside from all of that, people should be able to vote. It should be easy to vote. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. And this was a poor performance. You know, whether he should have been fired, I don't know. One thing I do think is that this puts into sharp focus, the big winner on Election Day was the voting center system that's run in Maricopa County that Fontes put in place and Stephen Richer has, you know, continued to improve upon. That if Pinal ran their elections the way we run them in Maricopa County, this wouldn't have happened because it wouldn't have been individual precincts that had to get specific ballots. They could have printed them there. And so I do think it was a shame what happened, and we got to get it fixed.
Okay. Tony Connie, Christine Jones, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Take care.
Thanks.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Eric Thomas has written in many forms. He'll be talking with us about his most recent book, a young adult novel.
But first, TV viewers have been fascinated by cooking shows for decades, probably starting with Julia Child on The French Chef in the 1960s. Fast forward to more recent years, and there's Anthony Bourdain, Gordon Ramsay, and wall-to-wall kitchen competitions on Food Network. The newest addition is the FX drama The Bear, which streams on Hulu. It features a young chef who leaves a job in a high-end restaurant to take over his late brother's role as the head of his family's sandwich shop. Valley chef Adam Allison of the Handlebar Diner and Brightside Burgers says The Bear reminds him of his own cooking career. I caught up with him earlier and asked what his expectations were for the program.
I saw a couple of previews about it, and it kind of looked like something that, you know, it was going to show like the real life scenario of working in a kitchen and not like the glamour that a lot of movies may show. So that's kind of like what I was expecting was going to be like the nitty gritty part of the kitchen, like kind of like the Anthony Bourdain book. Mm-hmm. That's how they want to take the show.
And so once you actually saw it and I guess got hooked on it, did it give you that accuracy you were looking for? And what else did it give you?
I ended up watching the entire series in one night, just because, you know, it just was one of those shows where like you just related so much to it. You wanted to keep watching. It's what I expected. The realism that it had, you know, it had I think the little things is what kind of got me is, you know, you can have some truths about kitchen and like the big aspect of like, you know, the chef is a mean guy or something like that. But there are little things that happen throughout the show that I was like, that's either me or I've seen that, you know, just like kind of like little things, like, you know, whether it was that they, you know, someone sold drugs, not that I did, but like, you know, I've heard of people selling drugs in order to pay their rent, or, like doing like kids' birthday parties in order, you know, to make it a little extra money. The health inspection ordeal, like what they used to drink water out of, the things they say. So everything about it was truly authentic.
So was the familiarity, authenticity, was that comforting in some way? In other ways, was it like, wow, that nailed it so much that it's almost like I'm almost taken aback by it?
I think it was a little bit of both. You know, there was comfort in it because then you kind of felt like, okay, so I'm not the only one going crazy, you know, being a chef. There's actual show and there must be some realism to it if I'm seeing it on TV. But then also it was kind of like a self-reflection. You know, like I said, I saw a lot of similarities, you know, as the head chef there in myself. And it was kind of like, wow, like, you know, it's kind of a way to step back and look from the outside in. So, you know, it kind of gave me a little both.
For you and Carmi, the lead character, what are some things that really struck you as hitting right between the eyes as an experience you've had?
The restaurants that I own in Denver, one of them is a really out of a food truck, and the kitchen is the other one is out of a trailer, and we do like burgers and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm a classically trained French chef, and I'm in a diner doing burgers, you know. So when he was in there and he's trying to make the best, you know, Italian beef sandwich, that's kind of me, but doing burgers, you know what I mean? So that's kind of like the where, you know, he's kind of felt like he was below his level and then trying to kind of save the place. You know, I have a lot of experiences with that. And, you know, all the taxes and going through the stuff that you don't see, you know, chefs do that aren't even cooking. You know, it's the business side of it that a lot of people don't realize that chefs spend half their time doing. And so all of that just, you know, very specific things just kind of hit home of things that I've, you know, seen in myself.
How did you end up on this path to being a chef? Because we know it wasn't like a straight line. But when did you decide this is something you had to try? And then when did you determine you really loved it?
My first job I got when I was 15 was at a pizza place making pizzas. And I just always, you know, as a kid growing up, you know, I was in the kitchen a lot with my grandmother who cooked all the time. So I saw cooking and food, you know, it was in the South. So it was a lot of big food and, you know, fried chicken, all that kind of stuff that made you happy. And I worked in restaurants all through high school and college. And, you know, I was in college to be a lawyer. I dropped out and, I was just sitting on the couch one day, kind of like, what am I going to do with myself? And like, you know, you've been cooking and I didn't realize it could have been an artistic thing. You know, I also played music before just being a chef. So that kind of translated well that you can create your own dish and, you know, kind of put yourself out on that plate instead of just going into a restaurant and cooking a dish. So once I saw that, I saw, you know, an advertisement for the Cordon Bleu in Scottsdale, the culinary school there. So I applied and went there. And then right out of that, I just kind of got an executive chef job right out of school. And then, you know, just my path from then just kind of led me to where I am now.
What do you think fascinates an audience about people who are chefs or people who run restaurants, whether it's The Bear or whether it's how popular Food Network is, for example? Why do you think the public's so interested?
You know, I think there's several different reasons. You know, obviously I think people like to eat and they like food and like going out and entertainment. And a lot of times you don't see the chef. They're in a room in the back, you know, but you get this food. And so people are just kind of intrigued about what goes on behind the doors, you know. No one really has a bunch of shows about, you know, like what are the servers doing or the bartender, you know what I mean? Like, because they see them, they talk to them. You know, they don't talk to the chefs, they don't see the chefs, and they're in the back and they're creating this food that you go out and pay a lot of money for and see. That, you know, and also couple it with the fact that most chefs have very large personalities and are very entertaining. Like if you look at, like, you know, Guy Fieri and, you know, Gordon Ramsay and all those chefs, like they're very large personalities and very entertaining. So not only do you get to see behind the scenes, but you get to see behind the scenes of them being just crazy people.
Are there any things in the Bear that would be potentially scary to people who are not in the restaurant business?
I think just the intensity, you know, like the way that, you know, something that was kind of funny happened to me, like happened to them on the show. Like we forgot to turn off our online ordering. And we opened up to a bunch of orders right off the bat, and kind of in the show that happens as well. I was like, oh, well, that literally happens. You know, things you don't expect, people not showing up to work and you have to cover for them. The different employees quitting in the middle of a shift. So like I said, like yelling the back and forth, you know, pans hot, everything's hot, you know, like you're not burning yourself. And I think just the intensity of it all is kind of what maybe could kind of scares like, is it really that crazy back there? And you're like, yeah, it's really that crazy back there, you know?
So Adam, as we said, there were 8 episodes, you binged them. Are you going to watch them again? Have you watched them again?
I have. After I binged it, I wanted to kind of take it slow and just kind of go through each one. Cause like I said, it's fun finding like, oh yeah. You know, like I saw something online, he drinks out of a deli, 32-ounce deli plastic container with a lid. And that's what we do. You know, like they're so on and how precise they were with, whoever wrote it probably, you know, had a lot of help with a lot of chefs. And like, this is we like kitchen talk. Like when you walk behind someone, you say behind, and there's a part that in the show where I believe it's the sous chef. She walks behind, doesn't say behind. They knock into each other and spill stuff. They're like, you're supposed to say behind. And like that stuff, that kind of stuff happens all the time, you know? So I want to watch it again to see all that kind of little stuff.
Adam Allison, chef at Handlebar Diner, Brightside Burgers. We've been talking about the new series, The Bear. Adam, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. There has been a lot of talk over the last year or so about the kinds of books students should and should not be reading in school, and what books kids should have access to in libraries. At the same time, there are more books being published that deal with issues of race, gender, and sexual orientation. We've been talking to the authors of some of those books in a series called Lit Squad, and today we hear from Eric Thomas. He writes for TV, The Stage, and has written 2 nonfiction books, but he's now jumped into the young adult genre with a novel called The Kings of Beemore. It tells the story of 2 black queer best friends, one of whom is moving away. Before that, though, they have a grand day out together. I spoke with Thomas earlier and asked why he decided to write for young adults.
Well, I remember really vividly there's a transition that I went through in as a young reader. My school had like a lower school library and then an upper school library. And the upper school library was sort of more of a general library, and the lower school was children's, middle grade, and young adult. And I remember sort of passing through those doors as my reading level changed, and having a couple years where I was always kind of floating in between those 2 spaces. And I remember that period being really vivid in terms of emotion and curiosity and change. And I wanted to honor that period for other readers and for myself. I've always loved novels. I've always thought in terms of fictional worlds. And I really thought that it would be a treat for myself as a writer to go back to that space and to create something new.
Did it turn out to be as much of a treat as you thought it would be?
You know, I have to say, it really was. This was the easiest book I've written, which I was like, why wasn't I doing this all before? And I thought it would be a little harder because, you know, I'm 41 years old, and I'm the main characters in the book are both 16 years old, and they're living in the present. And so I had to do, you know, a lot of like logistical research, you know, talking to teenagers that I know, like, what platforms do you use to message? You know, what are you listening to? How do you see the world? But at the end of the day, what I was doing was also just creating fully formed human characters. The main characters are both Black kids, they're both queer kids, they're both out. And so I was both giving them a part of who I used to be, but also giving them a part of who I've learned how to be in the present. And I think the sort of basic humanity kind of bridged all these gaps. It's also just a very fun book. And so I created this cast of characters that I like to refer to as like a Muppet movie cast. just a lot of big personality. And that was a lot of fun to return to every day.
That's so interesting what you said about how you combined who you were at that age, but also who you have learned to be, and putting those attributes back in a couple of 16-year-old kids. Such an interesting comparison.
Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to be very careful not to give them any knowledge that's adult knowledge. You know, that's things that I've earned or learned over the years. But I did know that, you know, the person that I was at 16, I want better for him. And I think that both because of the changes in time and also just sort of the circumstances that Harrison and Linus, our main characters, live in, they can have a little bit more and they can see themselves more fully and more expansively.
So I want to ask you a little bit about the research that you did, because I'm so intrigued by the concept of grown-ups writing, you know, characters who are teenagers or young adults. And I always go back to those movies where, you know, police officers or detectives go undercover in high school and, you know, they think they're going to fit in and they walk around saying things that maybe they said 20 years ago when they were kids. Like, mm-hmm. I would imagine it was, you know, you referenced being able to talk to teenagers that you know, but like, how much did you have to sort of take out of your mind what life was like and what being a teenager was like when you were a teenager? Because obviously 41 is not old, but to a 16-year-old, like, that's ancient.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, you know, I went back to my old high school and I did different conversations for other projects. And I'm sort of in the back of my mind thinking through like this project and you know, taking information like a little magpie and realizing as we're talking, that the world that I knew was completely different. And, you know, I went to a Gay Straight Alliance meeting at my old high school, and they were like, what was the Gay Straight Alliance like back then? And I was like, the what? Like, we didn't, the words didn't even make sense to me. So I knew that in writing this, that there was one, culture moves so quickly. So, you know, I wrote it a year and a half ago. I knew that by the time it got published, it wouldn't make sense to be using slang or any references to songs that were popular back in January of 2020 or before then. So I had to sort of detach a little bit and remember sort of for me what the core of being a teenager was, which a lot of times was just enthusiasm and curiosity. And the difference was I didn't have the internet. So my enthusiasm, curiosity was going to the library. I was very into microfiche back then. You know, like really just like real detective work. And these kids can just Google, you know, one of them is very interested in Broadway, very obsessed. And he just gets to Google, you know, Audra McDonald Tony Award performances all the time, which is what I do. But I'm like, that is the gift of time that bridges all ages is Audra McDonald.
What was it like writing these particular characters, knowing sort of the political climate in which you were writing, in which not everybody is okay with kids reading stories about gay characters?
Yeah, no, I thought about that a little bit. And, you know, I think that I remember my experience of being a teenager and understanding how my mind was expanding and changing the conversations that I was having. And so I think there's a lot of different texts that are appropriate for kids. What I wanted to do with this book was to basically create kind of a John Hughes movie in print form with these two characters who you wouldn't necessarily see in a John Hughes movie. It's loosely an homage to Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And in that sense, you know, there is, I think people have a lot of concern about what am I going to read in this book that's going to expose, you know, my kids to ideas that are too mature for them. And that's just not a concern that is accurate for this book, you know, because these are humans first, and they're exploring the world in a sort of day-long adventure. And, you know, I didn't set out to make it a very, like, this book must be PG, but I did set out to make it a book that reinforced that these kids are kids, that they are coming into their own in the world, and that the adventure that they're having is outside and in public and centered around joy. And so, yeah, they do go to a pride parade, and they do go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And for some people, those are places that a kid, that they don't want a kid. I just simply don't agree that that's not appropriate. And I think the text bears that out.
All right. That is writer Eric Thomas. His debut young adult novel is called Kings of Bemore. Eric, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day. And every last thing. So we unpacked our
adjectives. Do you typically pack your adjectives?
I think I unpack adverbs more often.
Do you do it quickly?
A big LY fan.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You probably do it very quickly. But carefully.
You've got your adverbs in.
Just like to show I know what an adverb is.
Yes.
All right. That is Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great rest of your day. Have a great weekend. See you back here on Monday.
That's it for this episode of the Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Steve Goldstein. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, thanks for listening today. This can show you which way. Adjectives are-